Okay, well, it's already on my clock here. It's 9 o'clock, so I want to get started. I know last time we had over 30 people. More people, no doubt, will be coming on, but I want to get started, especially I have about 30 books on the desk here. A number of people ask questions, and I want to get to them before we turn to the main topic of today. Now, first, let me, David Zilberberg, I thank you, David, for pointing out to me Yeshiva Flatbush was founded in 1927. I was talking about early day school, so thank you about that. Let me show everyone this book. By the way, when I show a book, for those who are new, you can enlarge my picture by going to the lower right-hand corner, and therefore you could, and stretching it out, therefore you could see better, perhaps. Here's a new book that came out on Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. We had classes on Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, so these are translation from German of all sorts of essays of his. Some of you might find that interesting. I was asked, are the minhagim, the customs of Morocco, the same as the ones in Tunisia? And absolutely not. Tunisia has different minhagim. Anyone who's interested in the Sephardic minhagim can check out a book. It's about six volumes. Here's one of the volumes, Keter Shem Tov of Rav Shem Tov Geguin. He was the Av Beis Din of London for the Sephardim, and he gives you all the different minhagim. So it's a fascinating and important book. In fact, there are many strange minhagim in Tunisia also. First of all, you have minhagim in Djerba, which is the island, and then you have in Tunis. Just to give you one example, in Tunis, they did not read the Megillah on Purim with Trump. They just recited it. So, I mean, there's a big discussion of this and the details in Rav Mazuz's book, Sansan LeYair, but that's an old custom in Tunisia. There's still, by the way, many people have asked me questions from last semester. I don't even know, maybe the last day, if we have time, I'll get to them, but you know, I try to do 10 minutes to keep up with the questions that are coming each class. Eventually, I'll get to some of the other stuff. In fact, one of the questions related to the Brisker Derech, we'll hold off on that till next semester, because next semester I'm going to do the Ridbaz, Rav Yaakov David Ulofsky, and he's known for his attacks on the Brisker method, so we'll deal with that. And when I get to that, I'll show you something else interesting in this Moroccan Sefer I mentioned last week from the Malach, Rafael Verdugo. Right at the end of last class, there was some discussion about forcing a husband to divorce his wife, and we spoke a little about Rav Moshe. In this Sefer, Manelig wrote, one of the things he attacks Rav Moshe on, and this is found right at the end of it, is Bidavar Ish She'ein Lo Gvuras Anashim V'Habal Lo Ratzal L'Garsha. Rav Moshe Feinstein's famous responsum that you can void a marriage if the man is impotent. And he doesn't want to give his wife a get, because after all, what woman would get married knowing that her husband is impotent? You know, that's such a basic point of marriage, both sex and children. He disagrees with Rav Moshe, so it's not a clear-cut matter. A couple more things. One of you asked me why it is, I seem to have papooed it at the end, that I make a bracha putting on tzitzis and also putting on a talis. Yes, it's true you have sources that say you shouldn't. But on the other hand, Rav Moshe Feinstein held that unless you were putting them on immediately, that is, putting on a talis katan and then putting on a talis gadol, you make another bracha. The Stiper also held similarly. Now, in terms of talis, I think Simchar, one of you asked me about this. I can't go into the whole detail now, but Otsar Yisrael, the encyclopedia, you have a nice entry on talis, and he speaks about the development of the practice of wearing a garment with tzitzis, etc. Also along those lines, I mentioned a bit about the idea of wrapping yourself. The Gemara, in a different context, speaks about the concept of atifa and mentions that it should be atifas Yishmaelim, like the Arabs wrap themselves. And there's a whole article on this in the latest issue of Chakira. That's the one that has the 40-page or 50-page essay responding to my book. But stay tuned for the next Chakira to see my response. And the essay is entitled Wrapping Ourselves Blindly. And they conclude, which is clear, that although the Ashkenazic custom is to wrap the talis completely around our face, that doesn't make any sense, because how could an Arab walk if his face is entirely wrapped around? Now, in Rav Mazuz's Siddur, this is how it says it should be. And he says, absolutely not the way we all do it, which is like that. But still, I don't think it has to be like that. I think that if you wrapped it around your mouth like this also, think of the Arabs walking in the desert. They wrap it around up to their nose. As long as the eyes are open, though, that would be what it means by atifa. Now, does this mean then we should all start doing this? Because that's obviously not the Ashkenazic minhag, and even though it's wrong, and there's no question it's wrong, I don't know, but I will tell you that the Minchas Elazar, who is certainly an Ashkenazi, he already pointed out that it's a mistake and the way people wrap themselves. One or two more points. I was asked, I think it was Chaim Landerer and some others, what's this business about the Moroccans using matches on Yom Tov? Well, it wasn't just matches, by the way. It also was, they used electric lights. Electric lights were used there. If you look in this sefer, again, we don't have time to go into it. This is Mikveh HaMayim from Rav Moshe Malka. Rav Moshe Malka was a Rav in Morocco, and then he came to Israel and was the Rav in Tel Aviv. I'll mention him again later today. He was pretty well known in Israel because he was the one that led the protests against, I think it was a movie theater opened on Petah Tikva on Friday night. They gathered there every week. I think it was close to a year. And he was the leader of this. And then, it's interesting, and a whole book came out about this, entitled The Battle for the Shabbos in Petah Tikva. And then after about a year, he decided, Chaim Lander, you are anticipating me. Okay, so he did. He published in Tehumen an article explaining why he's backing out and there shouldn't be these protests anymore. And he explains, and this is relevant to a lot of things, that, I mean, he had these protests, these crazy protests over Shabbos in the Eid HaCharedit. He says his big point is, first of all, these people already know, we've told them, we've given them tochacha, we've given them rebuke. All we're doing now is making a statement. And the fact is, every one of these statements, you're forcing policemen and others to be Mechal Shabbos, and we're turning people off to Judaism, so he pulled out. Now, you are right, Chaim. I'll get to you in a second, Dovi. We're right to Chaim that he writes about it, but in this sefer, the Heshiv Moshe, which I mentioned last week, this is the sefer that also has his notes on the Torah Tamima. He not only reprints his article, he reprints letters from Rabbanim Gedolim to him. First of all, those who support him, a number of big Rabbanim supported him in this, that it was wrong to continue the protests, including Rav Kafach. And this Rav Kafach's letter is amazing. You think of Rav Kafach, you know, he's a Tzioni, but in his letter, he says that you're absolutely right, there's no need to do these protests, and then he says, listen to this, concluding his letter, Anu chayim b'tkufa shel shmad, we are living in an era of religious persecution. It hurts me to say this, Yad kol tzorei tart Yisrael ramah. He says, believe it or not, that I don't know if we've had a worse time as this since the days of Isabel and Atalia, the wicked ones. So this is Rav Kafach, a Zionist, reflecting on religious life in Israel. I mean, it's hard for me to see this as an accurate reflection. It could be he was just in a very annoyed mood. But it's a fascinating letter. And yet, in addition to all the letters from Rav Shlush, Rav Chaim David Halevi, and others, he also reprints a letter from Rav Elyashiv, in which Rav Elyashiv tells him not to stop the protests, to continue the protests, and he responds to the letter, so that's interesting. But in the Mikveh HaMayim, Volume 6, he explains why in Morocco, what the idea was that they felt that you could light a match on Shabbos, and it's not just Morocco, there's a great Egyptian posek who ruled similarly. Yes, that's, if you plug into... I didn't remember it was 9. Thank you. If you plug in, I remember I found it. I plugged into the Bar Ilan computer to see how many people would cite the Mon El Igrot. We spoke about the Mon El Igrot when we dealt with Rav Moshe. It's a sefer full of learning. It's now on, they put it on HebrewBooks.org in the latest update that came out today or yesterday. But Rav Avadia is practically the only person, I think maybe the only one who quotes him, and at one time he rebukes him and says that he has a point, but it should be done with kavod. Two more points before we continue. I read over again the biography of Rav Mesas. Here it is. It's Orosh El Yerushalayim, that section. And I actually was wrong. It wasn't when he didn't start the school in 1942. That's when the yeshiva was started. He started the day school sometimes in the 30s, but it's not clear exactly when. But what I find is amazing that in 1955, there was, and this is the Aliyah has already started, it was the only school in Meknes, there was 1,300 students in this day school. I mean, do we have any Jewish day schools with that many students? And so it's really amazing. Two more points. One more point. I mentioned last class this Sefer, Ateret Shlomo, or Rav Shlomo Dayan. I actually read the entire responsum, the first one, dealing with the practice of not wearing a talis in Morocco. And what I can tell you is that he claims that in the north, in Tetuan, they did wear a talis katan, tzitzis. So what I can say is that obviously we have the testimony of Rav Yosef Masas, we have other testimony that they absolutely did not wear a talis katan in Morocco. So what we have to say is that there are different minhagim, different practices in Morocco. With that, I am ready to start today, unless anyone has any questions on what I said quickly now. I know others of you emailed me. I said I'd get to it. Maybe next week I'll get to it. Okay. Then we ended last class dealing with conversion. And I mentioned that the people who converted in Morocco accepted Judaism, but they were not the greatest tzaddikim, because in the sense that if they were not going to be, the only reason they wanted to convert is because they were going to marry someone or were civilly married, and they were going to remain civilly married even if they weren't converted. And they never became orthodox, rarely in the sense we think of it. But that was never expectation in Morocco. The expectation was not that you'd become immediately pious, was that you become part of the community, you'd educate your children Jewishly, and you'd grow in Judaism like everyone else. Simply accepting the God of Israel and the Torah in the general sense and joining the community and becoming a part of the community was sufficient. They never looked in exact details if you violate this or that. Everyone basically became a member of the community, and there was one community. And this was the approach of the Chief Rabbinate of Israel for many years. Now, Rav Shalom Messas writes that we have a situation like this. If we don't convert the non-Jewish partner, they will get married civilly, and the non-Jew will cause the Jew to forget about Judaism, and the children will be lost forever. And he says as follows, quote, "By doing this, we saved many families who were pushed away in France, and we brought them close here after that we saw that they came with good intentions." No one was intermarrying with the Arabs. We're talking about Jews intermarrying with the French. And Rav Messas says they were more strict in France, and he pushed people away. We brought them close. Elsewhere, Rav Messas says, though, that he says as a general rule, he wouldn't convert men. He would only convert women, because he had experience that when he converted the men, they fell back and they brought the women with them. But when the man was Jewish and the woman converted, certainly in a patriarchal society, the woman would follow the man's practices. But I can't imagine this is a general rule. And we have lots of other tshuvot from North Africa in which they did convert. In the Saul Berman Jubilee volume, which should be coming out soon, I published a tshuva from Sephardic Rabbanim, in which they are willing to convert a French soldier who falls in love with a Jewish girl in Lebanon. And they cite the exact same sources that Rav Shalom Messas cites, the tshuva of the Rambam, if I recall, and others. Now, Rav Messas quotes a tshuva, a responsum, from leading Moroccan rabbis from early in the 20th century, in which they agree to follow the Rambam we mentioned last class. That is, the Beis Din should do something which technically is not correct, convert someone for the purpose of marriage, because this is better than the alternative of losing the family in its entirety. And Rav Messas, after quoting this tshuva, and he's quoting from an era when intermarriage was extremely rare, I think it was the 1920s, he says, quote, "If they said so in our days," that is, if these great rabbis, one was Rafal Ankawa and others, said that the Beis Din should convert for the sake of marriage, if they said so in their days, Kalva Chomer, all the more so in our days, when Jews and Gentiles mix together. And what will the young man do? He is almost an anus. He's almost forced. This is very much like Rav Kook. Rav Kook spoke about how the non-religious today, they're sort of forced in their irreligiosity because the environment of today's society puts all these images in front of them and shows them that not to be religious is the best way. So they're basically forced in this fashion. They've been brainwashed. That Rav Messas says the same thing. So if he comes on his own and asks us to convert his fiancée, and she is willing, it is our obligation to help him so that he and his children remain in the religion. I mean, remember, his children, if we don't convert them, are not going to be Jewish. However, Mesa says that the children of a Jewish man, this really harkens back to what we spoke about with Rav Kalischer, and Rav Uziel as well, that the children of a Jewish man, even with a non-Jewish woman, have some sort of a zerakoda, some sort of an element of Jewishness connected to them. They're not halachically Jewish. And instead of losing one who would assimilate with the Christians, we save an entire family to bring them close to belief in God, and this was the work of our holy forefathers, Abraham and Isaac. Yes, this was the general practice, and truthfully, when I gave this talk on Morocco, until about 2 years ago, I said as follows. I said, Rav Nessas points out that it's our obligation to help him for the sake of him and his children. And I said that I think most rabbis in this country today would be outraged by this approach. Help one who wants to enter and wants to marry a non-Jew? The rabbis I know regard this person as out of the fold and certainly not deserving of any help from the Orthodox community. However, a couple of years ago, this Haredi organization, Eternal Jewish Family, began, and they started a whole effort, which has been controversial in their community, of outreach to the intermarried and converting them. So I sort of have to retract that statement. But certainly for a long time, it could be said that Orthodox rabbis in the United States did not feel any responsibility for people like that. I mean, if you're going to go and be with a non-Jewish girl, first of all, most of these people are not Orthodox. They're from the conservative Reform communities. And if it so happens that someone from the Orthodox world goes there, it's not our responsibility. Let them go to the conservative or the Reform rabbi. But in Morocco, you can't say things like that. There's no communities. There's not the Orthodox rabbi today sits in his community, and what goes on in the Reform community, that's their problem. And, you know, if they're intermarrying, that's their problem. That's not our community. We don't lower our standards for that community. But in Morocco, there's one community. Everyone goes to the same shul. You have some people who are more observant and some are less observant. But everyone goes to the same shul, the same rabbi. So the rabbi of the traditional shul, the only shul, you know, it's the old slogan, the shul I don't go to is the Orthodox shul. The rabbi in Morocco is the rabbi of everyone. He can't throw up his hands and say, well, they're not my community. The whole community is his community. And therefore, they had a very different approach. There was more of a sense of responsibility. There was no such thing as leaving Orthodoxy. There wasn't Orthodoxy. There was just traditional Judaism. And that was, as Simcha points out, the approach of RCA rabbis who were in these small towns and other places where you had a non-observant Orthodox population. We don't have that much of it today. Today, most of the Orthodox shuls, though, when you go out west, you have a lot more of that. But in the New York area, we don't have non-observant Orthodox anymore. I mean, my shul, 500-600 families, everyone Shomer Shabbos. So the rabbis don't need to be concerned with these issues anymore, and it creates certain issues, problems. Let me talk about a few other interesting responses of Rav Mesas. We don't have time to go into all of them, but let me just mention a few of them. We spoke about Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's true. So what you're saying is correct, Simcha. Now, on the one hand, it's great that we closed down the Hebrew schools because everyone is religious in our communities and sends their kids to yeshiva. On the other hand, what this means in the New York area is that no non-Orthodox Jew comes into an Orthodox shul, unless you're in an unusual place. But I'm talking about in the big cities, Teaneck, West Orange. There's no place for them there because they'll feel out of place if they're not Shomer Shabbos. So the rabbis in these communities only minister to the observant. However, when you leave the big cities, you still have plenty of rabbis. I've been to these synagogues with non-observant Orthodox, and they do have chance for outreach. And my friends have had to deal with these same problems. But today, the difference is that if they try to convert these people or do things like that, it'll create problems with the RCA or the CRC. And Chabad's a completely different phenomenon. That's what they devote themselves to. We spoke about Rav Moshe, his tshuva about allowing a sperm donor who's not Jewish, which was a huge controversy. If you want to get a sense of this, there were two rabbinic journals in America in the 50s. There was one called Hapardes, which was the standard yeshiva type, Agudas Yisrael, but no, it was Agudas Rabbani. And the editorials carried a Agudas Yisrael tilt, but it wasn't an Agudas Yisrael paper. And you have plenty of Mizrahi Rabbani who published for it because Mizrahi Rabbani were in Agudas Rabbani also. The chief rabbis of Israel always published in it. And this was really the mainstream rabbinic publication. and you can see it on HebrewBooks.org. And anyone who writes the history of Orthodoxy in America, the way I spoke about it last week, not the way Jeffrey Gurux does it, more social history, but what I spoke about, really religious history, you need to go to Hapardes. The other one was known as Hamaor, edited by Rameir Amstel, and that was really the journal for the Hungarians, the extremists, the Satmar and the like. And they had no really involvement with the wider Orthodox community. And I know this person. His name is Oberlander. He is the same family that edits this journal out of Muncie, but he's the rabbi in Budapest. He's a Chabad rabbi there. This family, Oberlander, comes from Hungarian Hasidim, and they became Chabad, I don't know how many years, 30 years ago or something. It's quite incredible that you have Satmar types becoming Chabad, and big Talmid Chachamim, every one of them. He told me that growing up in Williamsburg, they thought of Rav Moshe Feinstein as the posek for the modern Orthodox, that he was hardly reliable and not someone that they held of, obviously. So when Rav Moshe Feinstein came out with his responsum permitting non-Jewish sperm donor, the attacks were incredible. And you can read in Hamaor the vicious assaults. They even declared a cheirim against anyone who would use this. Satmarov came out. Huge dispute, maybe the greatest halachic dispute of that era in America. When Rav Mesas deals with this in Volume 4 of his Tshuvot, it's not even an issue for him. He doesn't consider it a problem. It's obvious that if it's a non-Jewish sperm donor, no problem. In that same volume, it's Shemesh Umagen, Volume 4. I have it here. Actually, this is Volume 3, but you can see nice. I'll show you his picture again. And for those who are coming on, you can enlarge the pictures if you want to see the books I show. Go into the lower right-hand corner and stretch it out. He deals with another interesting problem, which is American rabbis for a long time have had to deal with. And according to Rabbi Broyd, I asked him, there is no policy for the RCA or for rabbis in America. The Shulchan Aruch has a halacha that a Kohen is not permitted to marry a girl whose father isn't Jewish. Interesting halacha. It would come up today. It's going to come up a lot. Now, Yechiel of Weinberg discusses this. He had a case like this where the people were in love, and he felt the Shulchan Aruch was wrong, because the Shulchan Aruch's position is that he takes the three big poskim, the Rif, the Rush, and the Rambam, and he decides like the majority. And in this case, the Shulchan Aruch went against his own principle. And, yes, Robert wrote an article. That's right. You remind me. We spoke about this before. And he quotes the source I'm going to mention. But he doesn't get into what I'm going to mention now, I don't think. The Sri D.H. says that he thinks the Shulchan Aruch is wrong. He even uses an amazing expression, which I've never seen in contemporary rabbinic literature. He says about a prohibition in the Shulchan Aruch, quote, he says that this prohibition in the Shulchan Aruch causes him great pain. Usually we're accustomed to think of Orthodox rabbis being apologists, always trying to justify the Shulchan Aruch, why it's correct. No, he thinks the Shulchan Aruch is wrong, because the two of the three big Rishonim rule that the girl could get married, and the Shulchan Aruch didn't go against his own principle. And the Sri D'Eish was willing to rule against the Shulchan Aruch if the Vilna Gaon went against the Shulchan Aruch. But in this case, the Vilna Gaon agreed with the Shulchan Aruch. So the Sri D'Eish, what can he do? He throws up his hands and says, I guess this is faith. He's not a conservative rabbi. He doesn't fall back on conscience. Like the conservatives, they have a principle that you try to find a heter in cases like this, but if you can't, you just fall back on conscience. So therefore, a Kohen can marry a divorcee and all these things. He throws up his hands and says, I think it's wrong. The halacha shouldn't be this way, but the Shulchan Aruch says it, and therefore we have to follow it. Now, Rav Moshe Feinstein also says you have to follow it, and although I was told by the rabbi in New Rochelle, Rabbi Fink, that he believes, he's a student of Rav Moshe, in certain cases, Rav Moshe ruled that they could get married. Now, what makes this interesting is that if they do get married, they don't have to get divorced. It's only an ab initio, a chachila ruling. Now, Rav Shalom Mesas really was at the forefront, and as far as I know, he's really the first posek to push this, that if the couple is already involved, if they're in love, that has the status of the diavad after the fact, and therefore it's as if they're married, and you can marry them. In other words, we don't set up people. I don't try to set up a Kohen with a girl whose father's not Jewish. However, if they on their own are already together and they're involved, we can marry them. And let me talk about the social implications of this for a minute. Let me begin by saying that Rabbi Bleich, in his column in Tradition, spoke about this a few issues ago also, when he dealt with Remesas Tshuva. And this is really what bothers me about Rabbi Bleich in all of his essays, is he's very, I don't want to use the word objective, but he just looks at it in a detached manner, as if he's discussing, using a teabag on Shabbos. It's not an accident that Rav Shlomo Messas comes to his conclusion. You have a posek here, and you who knows the other positions, but yet in a Shas HaDachak, you have the validity and you have the flexibility to rely on opinions that are not, let's say, the typical opinions. So when Rabbi Bleich rejects this and concludes, well, this is not the mainstream opinion, he's missing the point. And Rav Messas, coming from Morocco, where he's not just dealing with Orthodox Jews, he has an appreciation and understanding of this. What's the situation? You're in Israel, and you have a situation like this, and these people are in love. They're going to get married anyway if they have to go to Cyprus. If you tell them you're not going to marry them, then you can be sure they're going to get civilly married. They're going to be together. They're not going to be married. They'll just live together. You're not going to see them in shul. You've just told them that in Europe, their lifestyle is against Judaism, and 9 times out of 10, maybe 99 out of 100, you basically push them away forever. However, if you regard this as a shas of the chak, an emergency situation, and you think it's important to try to find a way to marry them, then you're opening the door for these people to perhaps become Balei Tshuva, to be part of the fold, people who know that their marriage is rejected by the rabbis, they're living in sin in their minds, they're not going to have any interest in being part of the religious community. I have no doubt that that's part of the important thing pushing Rav Messas, why he's willing to go this way, although he justifies it, luckily, and he gets Rav Avad Yosef to agree with him. He has tshuva after tshuva, responsum after responsum, justifying this. And this is very significant in Israel, because Rav Amar, who's also Moroccan and to a large degree follows, he follows Rav Avadia and follows Rav Messas, he, as head of the Beis Din now, is instituting this in practice in Israel. And if you look at Bleich and Tradition, he doesn't understand. He doesn't say, just because you have a different position, you can overrule the lower courts. This isn't how courts of appeals work. But that is the halachic position now of the Batei Din in Israel, that if they're in love and they're involved, that has the status as if they're already married, or if they already have kiddushin, not nisuin, and therefore we can marry them. Now, Rabbi Weinberg didn't know about this position. This is a tradition. Rav Messas didn't make it up, but he's now made it public and well known. Had Rav Yechiyakov Weinberg known about this position, he would have jumped for joy. He would have been happy, and he would have been able to use this. Because he didn't know about it, he was forced to tell this young couple that he couldn't marry them. And who knows what became of them? No doubt they went to the Reform Rabbi or something, and then they've been lost to Judaism forever. But he didn't know that tradition. So that's significant. Let me tell you another, give you another example of Rav Messas. And this comes from Volume 3 of Shema Shemagin, page 94. And historically, it's very significant. It's his notes to a book. A book appears called Mitzvat HaNashim, Halachas for a Woman. And the author of this book he spoke about these women that don't make brachas. They eat without making brachas. Women. And he says that that these women and their fathers and their husbands are going in the future, latit et adin. They'll be punished in heaven. They're doing a terrible thing. And he spoke very strongly against how could they do this, great sin, etc. Rav Messas says as follows. God forbid for this person to curse generations of our forefathers, and its practice continued to my youth. There were no schools for girls. All the women got married when they were 10 or less, and they were under the control of their mothers-in-law, and they had many children. They didn't have time to learn anything. And this was the practice in Morocco. It's now different, he says, that we have schools, and they get married later, and it's good that they study. But in previous generations, the women knew nothing. There were no Ezrat Nashim in the synagogue. Even Yom Kippur, they didn't come to shul, because there's no one to understand. They would go every day before the mezuzah, they'd close their eyes and say a verse of Kriyat Shema and pray over their family. And they were careful and kosherous and Shabbos and Taras and Mishpacha, and therefore there's no room to criticize them. And he has numerous other tshuvot, about three or four that speak about this. And I published one in the YCT Chovei Torah Journal, a letter that Rav Mesas wrote to me about the same thing. I don't know about what the Ben Ishlai says about this, but I wrote to Rav Mesas and I asked him, you know, I can understand bracha achrona, that's a long bracha, they're not going to say that, but bracha rishona, our three-year-olds, our five-year-olds learn that. And he said, nope, they didn't say any brachas, which to me I find it's a little strange, because you could have taught them the bracha rishona, it's just one word. But this is the situation in Morocco, and not just in Morocco. You know, women did not daven in Europe, precisely because they didn't daven. The Magen Avraham says it's enough if they just say, you know, their own prayer they make up themselves. They have these things called tachinas for them. This is one area where there's been a real change. The modern Orthodox, you have women davening and girls davening. When they get married, I don't think they do, but when they're single. But in the Haredi world, they don't daven like the modern Orthodox. And I'll tell you an amazing story about this in a minute. The Chavetz Chaim's wife didn't daven. She used to sit next to her husband. Her son records in the biography while her husband benched. So obviously, when her husband wasn't around and she ate, she didn't do the bracha achrona. She didn't bench. And it's just amazing how different it is today that women had no religious life in the sense that they did not. They didn't say prayers, they didn't say brachas, things we take for granted. And he defends this. No, you're speaking, the Sefer, I'm talking about a modern Sefer. It's called Beit Yehudi. There's a section in there called Mitzvot HaNashim. But you're right, there is a book by the Ben Ishlai dealing with women. That's called, I think, Chukei HaNashim. I believe it's by, I forget who it's by. I want you to check your computers. It might be by this rabbi in Israel. He publishes Aaron Zakai, I think is the person who writes it. He publishes a million books. But Rav Mesas is doing is defending the Moroccan tradition. He says, and he says in his letter to me, if I recall correctly, that Baruch Hashem, things are better now. The girls get an education. But don't criticize our mothers and grandmothers. That was the way they did it. Even though the halacha is that they, according to the halacha, women do have to bench. They have to say a bracha achrona. I asked Rav Mesas' son, I have a letter from him, Rav Shalom Mesas, who's the chief rabbi at Paris. He said the exception was on Purim. On Purim, they'd read the Megillah for the women. But you know something? There's also a halacha that they have to make brachas, the same halacha. But they didn't. That was one of these things. No, the Chavetz Chaim's wife didn't. Well, the Chavetz Chaim's wife, her son, she didn't daven, as her son tells us. And her son tells us that she benched when she didn't know how to bench. She couldn't read Hebrew, I guess. She would sit next to her husband when the Chavetz Chaim benched, she'd sit next to him. So I'm thinking, what are all the times when the Chavetz Chaim isn't there? So she didn't bench. She didn't say bracha achrona. That's the only certain. Look, it's the great wives. I don't want to call them Rebbetzins. I didn't call them that. But if all the great wives, if the great wives of the Malach, Berdugo, and all the other great Rabbanim in Morocco, their wives did not bench and say brachas, I'm assuming the Chavetz Chaim's wife was no different. I don't know. The women couldn't read Hebrew. Whoever heard of a woman in Eastern Europe benching by themselves on Shabbos, they'd sit at the table. But if they had bread during the week, I'm assuming what the Chavetz Chaim's son is telling us, that his wife never his mother never davened, and when it was time to bench, if her husband, you know, she sat next to her husband. But this is before Beis Yaakov. So that's really interesting. The next point I want to talk about is, in addition, quite fascinating, and that's the Shadel issue, in which Rav Shalom Mesas took on Rav Avadi Yosef. We spoke last class about the numerous times he took him on. And this is, as I said, a fascinating issue and requires a bit of background. Shadels first come on the scene in the Renaissance in Italy. People, they came up with this practice. I don't think it was the rabbis. I think it was the masses. But I should say the masses, the elites. And there were certain important rabbis who went along with it, with the logic that it's not the original hair. However, a huge dispute broke out about this, and this went on for hundreds of years in Europe, because, after all, you could have the shadel, which is nicer than the original hair. You could look at it, you don't know it's a shadel, it's very pretty, and this would seem to be just complete undermining of the halacha. The woman's not supposed to be attractive to anyone but her husband, all the reasons given. And there are numerous authorities opposing the shadel. I will say, however, yeah, they talk about all these things. I think they say the reason they get, what they say that means is they cover it up. They put something on top of it. I have to check how they interpret all these things. Let's see. Yeah, there's a lot of books on this. In fact, there's one book, they discuss all these things. There's a difference between being in a courtyard and a Rishus HaRabim, and if you find, send me the mention in the mission, if you send me offline quickly at my email account, so I don't forget tonight, I'll look back at the sources next week. I can tell you what they do with the earlier sources about the Peya. There's even a book that was put out listing some 90 sources against Shadows, including the Maharetz Chayas, believe it or not, Ratzir Chayas, who we think of as a great liberal. One thing is crazy, though, really ridiculous. You have this group in B'nai Brak, especially Sfardim, who are so against it, and they add up all these poskim, and they say that the poskim against it are more than the poskim for it. This is complete nonsense. Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski supported wearing a shadel. His wife wore a shadel. He never wrote a tshuva. Every single Rav in Eastern Europe, and they were talking about hundreds of Mechavrei Sfarim, their wives wore shadels. Just because they never wrote responsa about it doesn't mean that they weren't supportive of it. You can't add up the shitas like that. When this chumrah began years ago, they went to Rav Shach, and they wanted to get him to ban the shadels, and he said, the Chavetz Chaim's wife wore a shadel. Okay, so that's the issue. Now, you have people like Rav Avadi Yosef, who's been at the forefront. In fact, in his school system now, teachers who wear shadels can't teach. And his position is that all shadels are bad. However, shadels obviously were the practice in Eastern Europe, became the practice in Eastern Europe. But now you might have known that there's a group of Ashkenazim who are pushing this also, and they even got Rav Yoshev to come out against shadels. What do I mean when I say against shadels? Because there's two types of shadels. There's the shadels from 75 years ago, or from, or even 40 years ago, in which everyone could look at it and see that it was a shadel. It was obvious, your grandmother's shadel, that sort of thing. And then there's the contemporary shadels. And Rav Yoshev's point is that the contemporary shadels are forbidden, not the old-time shadels. So we have, the new shadels come about approximately 20, 25 years ago. And this is very important sociologically, because shadels really went out of style for much of the Litvish Torah world, even their great rabbis. In the modern Orthodox world, they were unheard of. About 20 years ago, the trend starts changing. Before, in the Haredi world, it was more, about probably 35 years ago, when even you had Rashi Yeshiva, Litvish Rashi Yeshiva, Rabbanim, whose wives didn't wear shadels. The young generation, however, came back to this, and even in the modern Orthodox world, the YU graduates, etc., their wives begin wearing shadels to a significant extent. This never would have happened had it not been for the modern shadels. These women were not going to wear shadels that looked like their grandmother's shadels. The only way they would wear shadels if they were attractive, pretty shadels, which is what they are. However, this takes us... This creates a problem. Now, about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, a rabbi published a book about tznius. And he made the mistake of including in the book the preface that his wife is involved in shadels, makes shadels. And with the bloggers today, they don't let anything go. And some of them are ruthless. Now, one of these bloggers looked up and found out that what his wife made were shadels that can only be described as sexy shadels. And he started writing about this. And this became one of the cases, it's been about three, where someone wanted to sued one of these Jewish bloggers. There have been a few of these cases. So he asked, well, what about freedom of speech? It became a lawsuit. I mean, I was at the Israel Day Parade last Sunday, and we saw freedom of speech in action. You had the Neturei Karta standing there, waving the Palestinian flags, and right next to them were these Arabs holding up the following sign, close Guantanamo Bay, reopen Auschwitz. And the children all had to walk right past that, and these Rishayim, Neturei Karta, were standing there right together with them, and, I told you this a couple of semesters ago, that after the big rally in Washington, these Rishayim show up at one of the shuls in Washington. And there was a debate what to do. It was for davening. should they count them in a minion or should they kick them out? And I don't know what they concluded. I think it was for Indelshul. And truthfully, it's obvious. So if I was there, you have to throw them out. From this, first of all, pure halacha, you can't count them in a minyan. They're Rishayim Gemurim. It's a psak in the Rambam. Anyone who doesn't mourn with the Jewish people, not part of the Jewish people, is regarded as a heretic with all that that implies. And these people are obviously can't be counted in a minyan. You can't answer to their Kaddish. Not to mention the fact that even to share the same air with them is problematic. But so getting back to the blogger. Now this, the guy kept going and he didn't pay attention to this. The website for anyone who wants to look at it is Clary's Wigs, C-L-A-R-Y-S Wigs.com. And these wigs are sold everywhere. You can look where it's sold, all over Muncie, Brooklyn, etc. Now if you look at these wigs, you see exactly, so the point of this blogger was here you're talking about Snias, a whole book on Snias, and these wigs are the last thing of Snias. And what takes the cake is as follows. There is a wig here called the Pretty Woman wig. Inspired by the motion picture Pretty Woman, this style was by far a hit. Now, for those who don't know, let me remind you of something. In the movie Pretty Woman, starring Julia Roberts, she did not have the most sneistic profession, to put it mildly. But I tell you, you could not make this stuff up. This is what I mentioned last week. Here you have a shadel, which is supposed to be about sneus and implying modesty, and it is named after a prostitute. Named after the look of a prostitute in a movie. And Tarte de Satre, is there any, like I said, you cannot make this stuff up. A shadel named after the hairdo of a prostitute. This is the exact sort of thing that Rav Elyashiv and others find so upsetting and disappointing. And yet, Rav Mesas doesn't have a problem. And I'll read you. Well, it depends. Who said I don't follow the Rambam's Pesach? By the way, the Yud Gimel Karim, none of these are the ones I referred to there are not even mentioned in the Mishnah Torah. Look at the Mishnah Torah. In the Mishnah Torah, anyway, it's always HaOmer. It's never... But that's a different topic. If you want to have a topic on Yud Gimel Karim, we would. But I don't need the Rambam to tell us that you can't daven together with people who are friends with... the murderers of the Jewish people. You should know, by the way, to defend the Neturei Karta for a minute here. There's more than one Neturei Karta. I have a sefer from Neturei Karta in Israel, which is totally against this. The Neturei Karta you see at these rallies, they believe that when Jews are killed by Hamas terrorist attacks and things like that, you're supposed to send congratulations to the terrorists. And they cite a Gemara about this. The Neturei Karta in Israel is very different. They also are Neturei Karta, but they believe in working only internally. And the sefer I have, by a Sephardi, believe it or not, named Bitton, who's one of the leaders in the Neturei Karta in Israel, shows what an outrage these Neturei Karta are. And he mentions one of the Neturei Karta people who was even killed by a terrorist attack. So you could be Neturei Karta and oppose the state of Israel and not be what I would say a traitor to the Jews and not be like these people. These people literally are enemies. And if we had a Sanhedrin, they'd be executed. Their building was burned down in Muncie last year. But these are not like all Neturei Karta. Again, not to be a defender of Neturei Karta. But if someone wants to oppose the state of Israel, he just doesn't believe in it, that's his freedom. And he's certainly a Jew and he could be a tzaddik. I could send, if anyone's interested, I'll send you the information on this book where you can read about real Neturei Karta, the old-fashioned Neturei Karta, who do not believe in going out because this idea that you get together with Holocaust deniers and other types, Holocaust advocators, it's beyond comprehension. Now, Rav Mesas says something very interesting, though. In his debate with Rav Avadia, he doesn't argue, okay, you're right about the fancy shadels, these types of shadels, but the old-fashioned shadels, those are okay. No. Listen to what he says here. This is in Shemesh Umagen, volume 2, page 243. And I'm going to read in Hebrew and then translate it in English. Hadavar baro lehalacho lemaisa lehatir v'gam mitzvah v'chova ahanashim leitkashet lebaleihen leho olam beheter. He says, it's a mitzvah, an obligation for women to beautify themselves for their husband and for the entire world. And don't wear a kerchief and cause your husband to look at other women. Rav Mesas develops the idea in a number of tshuvot that there's nothing wrong with a shadel. For him, it's a technical thing. that you can show a woman's hair. That's erva. However, look, there's nothing wrong with a single girl walking around with a nice hairdo, with hair looking like this. And therefore, there's nothing wrong with a married woman walking around. If you're going to say, well, you can't tell, it looks like a shadow, men will look at her, that to him is not the issue. If a man looks at a married woman, then that's his problem. But the woman, he says, she's supposed to look nice for her husband, and basically she can look the exact same way she looked when she was single. It's a technical issue. And he says in a couple places, if you want to be machmir, you can be machmir. But if you try to make this a general rule, you're going to drive people away. So they're going to say, rightfully so, well, if I can't wear any shadow and I have to wear a kerchief, I might as well just not wear anything. And he develops that. Yes, Mohammed Harama. That's the sefer. I have it downstairs. And there's some others who've written on this thing as well. That's Rav Nesas. He was the leading advocate in the Sephardic world. The Ashkenazic world doesn't have this issue, really. But since Rav Avadya is the leading Sephardic figure, and he's so much against the shadels, the fact that Rav Nesas was there fighting the battle from the other side was what allowed many people, many very religious Sephardim, to feel that it's okay. They can still go with a shadel because Rav Anshel Yisrael, Rav Nesas, permits it. So then it's a machlokas of Gedolim, and since their practice was to, then others went along with Rav Avadya. Rav Mazuz went along with him, but not Rav Nesas. He has some just a couple other interesting shuvot in the time we have left here. I wrote about in the Sforim blog I'll get back to the Sforim blog in a minute. Let me go ahead and I'll come back to this because this is another issue that is relevant. A couple months ago, probably about 6 months ago or maybe a little more, Tzvi Zohar in Israel. He works at the Hartman Institute. He's an expert in Sephardic halacha, and he just came out with a book that he's edited. I just ordered it from Israel. Maybe by next week I'll have it, on 20th century Sephardic rabbanim. So I'm curious to see which rabbis are discussed in it. He wrote an article in Tzohar or Akdamot, I forget which one, saying that we need to bring back the institution of Pilegesh, concubine. Now, what is a concubine? Well, a concubine is basically a live-in girlfriend. Of course, the halachas of Taras and Mishpacha need to be followed. If you look in the medieval authorities, there's a dispute. Akdamot, thank you. The Rambam says it's forbidden, but the Raivad and the Ramban and really most of the medieval authorities say it's permitted. And I mean, there are some who say it's forbidden, no question, but it seems that most of the Rishonim say it's permitted, and this continues even until pre-modern times, that is the 16th century, 17th century, 18th century. In the last YCT journal, I had an article about this. Now, today, obviously, this is out of style. We don't consider this proper. We don't consider this moral. And the fact is that the Sri Deish writes that if you have a practice which is a dispute among the Rishonim, we should decide in accordance with what is regarded as moral in contemporary society. However, in the last 20 years, morality in the larger society has changed, and the larger world doesn't really see a problem with people, let's say, living together. And you have in the Orthodox world also. So Tzvi Zohar's point was that we need to revisit the issue of Pilegesh because these people now are, quote, living in sin, and since they're living in sin, then there's no Taras HaMishpacha, and then many of them just say, the hell with everything in Judaism, because, you know, if they're not in an acceptable relationship, they throw everything out. So he said, why not look back at the Sephardim rabbis, because the Sephardim really pushed this. Not only Sephardim, Rekav Emden is famous, but there are many 20th century, even Sephardic rabbis in 19th century who thought that this was something that was possible. And therefore, we can create a situation for all these people. They won't feel they're living in sin. They won't feel that it's a terrible thing to feel like you believe in Shabbos and Kashrus, but in this area, you know, you're not doing everything the community wants and you're going to give it all up. And the reaction, of course, was swift and strong. Understandably so. What I will say is two things, and this is what I mentioned. I wrote about on the Sforim blog. When people say things like living together before marriage is immoral, it's unethical, things like that, I have a real problem with this, because the Ramban said it's permissible, and the Ravid said it's permissible, and we could say that halachically, we could say it's not a good idea, or that halachically this is not the way we go, but to say it's unethical, say it's immoral, that to me is insulting our great sages. You know, it's, and especially today, no, people don't think it's unethical and immoral. And I wrote about this on the Svarim blog with regard to marriage. You have people who get up and they say things like, they don't just say that the approach we have to divorce is a more realistic approach, takes into account that people can't live together always, they need to separate, it's not like the Catholic approach or these other approaches, that's fine. But then often they go overboard and they start denigrating the other approaches and say this idea that you could never get divorced, or you can only get divorced if there's adultery, this is outrageous and it shows no sensitivity. What they're doing here is that they're insulting Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai's opinion is also a Torah opinion that we don't hold from him, although maybe in Messianic days we will. So they go overboard and they don't even realize this. And with regard to non-Jews, my friend told me the story that this Lubavitch woman, she goes around to these public schools and she speaks about the importance of marriage and not living together. As my friend said, but what's the problem? According to the halacha, there's no such thing as marriage for non-Jews. Well, they don't go to the priest and get married. Living together for them is marriage. So what do you? And she couldn't grasp this concept. I'll have to take a look at that, Dovi. Teret Paz is a great, great rabbi in Israel, Reb Zavichi. So getting back to my point and Tzvi Zohar. Do we bring back the Pilegish or not? I'm going to read you something which is amazing, and I was shocked when I saw it. Now, incidentally, there could be times when you might want to use Pilegish, or if Moshe Malka uses it, or Dosi Hoffman uses it. If you have a situation where you want to give a heter, like a Kohen and a convert, where it's an emergency situation, you certainly can't marry them, but maybe if they're going to be living together anyway, and if you establish a relationship, like a Pilegish relationship, then they'll go to the mikvah, and they'll still be part of the community. Again, here we're dealing with a situation where if you push people away completely, then you might lose them. So you have this idea of Pilegish. Listen to what Rav Mesa says. He's not talking about all these issues of... we have a problem. Here's the problem. You have an organization like the OU that puts out all this literature of how sex is so special, but it can only be with someone you're married, and if you remove it from the married relationship, it's dirty and it's wrong, and this idea that people would have sex without actually having full marriage. The Ramban thinks differently, and the Riva thinks differently, and many other Gedolim think differently. They think that the relationship of concubinage, of having a Pilegish, that for whatever the reason is, that they're not completely married, that's a validly Jewish approach. And, I don't think the OU and the rest need to sound like the evangelical Christians, because that wasn't the Rambam's reason either. For the Rambam, it's a technical thing. But the king is supposed to be the first among equals. He's supposed to be the one we look up to. You know, the king was, according to everyone, the king was allowed to have a Pilegish. So that certainly doesn't fit into the traditional marriage. So the whole thing, these evangelical ways to explain Jewish family values, it doesn't work when you have Rov Minyan or Binyan of Rishonim who have a different perspective on it, in my humble opinion. Pilegish relationship is... if you are the man and the woman is with the man exclusively, and there's a machokas among Rishonim. Some say that there's an actual kiddushin, others say there's not. But she's exclusively to the husband, and there's responsibilities. It's the equivalent of, let's say, living together, something like that. Listen to what Rav Mesa says, and I'll read it in Hebrew and then translate in English, just so you know I'm not making this up. He quotes some authorities, including the Malach, Rafael Berdugo, who say that it's permissible. Ein b'pilegish lehedyot shum isur rak mipnei shehi busham litvol. V'im tipol ein b'zeh shum isur. Rav Mesa says that according to the halacha, if the woman's going to go to the mikvah, there's no problem. That's the halacha. That's the halacha in Morocco. In Morocco, there's Jewish. I quoted it in my article where although in the end of the article, I said this isn't halacha l'maisa because today we don't do this. Although when I say we don't do this, I don't know what that means. If someone moves into my community and he's living with his girlfriend, and she goes to the mikveh, and she's this, you know, and he tells me he holds like the Ramban. What does it mean, we don't do that? We don't have to do it. He's doing it himself. It's not like we need to do anything. But Rav Nesas held that this was an acceptable relationship. What this means is that this opens up possibilities. I'm not saying that any rabbi is going to make this public, but you certainly could have circumstances where the Rav feels that he needs to tell the people, just because you're living together doesn't mean that it's all hefkeros. It doesn't mean that... you know, you've given up on Judaism. You can still be, you know, you can create a halachically valid relationship, even though that's not the goal. But Rav Nesas says that this idea that they're living in sin, we don't know from living in sin. We know about violating prohibitions. It could be the Nido prohibition. It could be something else. But in our, we have community standards. We could say that we don't want you in our community because we value marriage, and that's not appropriate. But this idea that we're going to say that we're going to create this evangelical type thing, Rav Nesas says otherwise. And again, he's not talking about the specific circumstance here of how this would apply. Rav Nesas wasn't getting up in Israel and saying we should bring back Pilavshim. Things could be permissible halachically, but not be a smart thing to do. But what he says is that halacha l'maisa, it's an acceptable thing, which opens the door. That's what's important for these emergency type of situations where the Rav might feel that he needs to use this pilegish option to save a family, to Yiddishkeit, or for something else. That's why I think it's significant. Now, how could there be a prohibition against a non-married woman going to a mikveh? What could the prohibition possibly be? Anyone go to a mikveh. What you have is you have a mikveh that says we will not allow the women to go. But how could you have a prohibition? And you know something? Let's say you're a Rav, and the local mikveh doesn't allow women to go, but you know that this woman should be going to the mikveh. I think the typical Rav would say just go to the mikveh. And I mean, we can't make this public, because then all these women would be going to the mikveh. But privately, if you ask the Rav on a personal basis, you think the Rav is going to say don't go? Rather stay home and don't go? And what mikveh asks you if you're married anyway? You know, if it's a big mikveh, anyone comes, they just go. But no, there's no halacha. Well, we have our gezerot. Rav Avad Yosef has in his shuva, he says, we can't permit this. But I think perhaps what he means there is that obviously we can't get up and allow it publicly. So if a woman's in town and she's living with a guy, she can't go to the mikveh where everyone knows her. Because that all of a sudden will destroy the fabric of Jewish life as we know it. And that's important too. However, if you ask Rav Avadya, can the woman say, can I go, there's a mikveh in a town, let's say 2 hours away, where no one knows me, and it would shock me if he would say, don't go. Already the Gemara says you're supposed to put on dark clothes and go to a city where no one knows you. Here she has a chance of purifying herself where no one knows her. I think any real Rav would have to weigh the pros and cons and would conclude that if you're in a situation where, for whatever reason, she's not going to get married and you can't change that and you can't allow her going to the mikveh here in your town because everyone knows her and that will create a problem, you're going to tell her not to go to another one, not to go to the lake or do what she needs to do there. They say that in Paris, Rav Yisrael Salanter, Rav Cook apparently said that in Paris, Rav Yisrael Salanter told the women, the single women, to go. Yeah, well, it's a takana. You're right. It's a takana. Cities have made that takana because then they're afraid that if they publicly permit it, then all the guys are going to be taking girlfriends. And this will, on the other hand, that's public. Privately, though, if you're dealing with a situation privately where no one knows it, I know for a fact that the typical Rav I know would say yes, do it privately. I mean, I don't. Maybe I'm wrong about this. And there have been plenty of cases where rabbis have given this heter, and that's the heter of the Pilegish. That's Dafka, she has to go. It's interesting, though. It's other rabbis, I might be wrong on this, there could be rabbis where if the girl comes to him and says, should I go to the mikveh, he might just say, no, you're sinning, you're going against our community standards, you're violating the Rambam about Pilegish, that we don't care about you anymore, you're out of the fold. But I don't know. I think that most rabbis would say, if you can lessen the Isser, lessen the Isser. I don't think I'm wrong about that. Then there have been plenty of places where rabbis did give that advice, and I just read it from Rav Nesas that if that's the situation. Do you invite them to your Shabbos table? Well, that's the old question with the homosexual couples and all these things, and everything now is changing in our day and age. It used to be that you didn't. Today, today it's a different world out there. It's today the outside world, first of all, doesn't even regard this as immoral. This is just regarded as a different lifestyle. So we have a halachic issue. I can tell you from being all over the country, they are invited to the Shabbos table, and why not? In my opinion, why not? What's the problem? We're supposed to start making rules over other people? It's their life. It's a different world out there. About the interesting that this, I mentioned this issue, and we'll end with this, about in Morocco, that these people, they don't realize they're offending Beit Shammai, they're degrading Beit Shammai when they speak about how any position other than the standard Jewish position we have today is a foolish position. When Beit Shammai had a different position, Rav Mesas writes that in Morocco, the practice was if the husband wanted to get divorced and the wife didn't, we would not allow them to get divorced on the first marriage. And he quotes numerous Rishonim who say, in Achronim, that Beit Hillel actually agrees with Beit Shammai on the first marriage. And the whole dispute, Beit Hillel says you can get married for any reason, Beit Shammai says it has to be Erevat Davar, sexual immorality, and then there's another opinion. That's all about the second marriage, not the first marriage. Now, I think this is a strange position, because if you look in the text, this doesn't seem to be the pshat, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was some influence of maybe the Christian environment pushing people into this, but he quotes Sephardic Gedolim, who are in the Islamic world, who say the same thing, that there's apparently a tradition that Beit Shammai agrees with Beit Hillel. Beit Hillel agrees with Beit Shammai that if one of the partners doesn't want a divorce, and it's the first marriage, we do not force a divorce, and we don't give the husband the permission to get divorced. Now, we don't do that anymore. I mentioned last class, the Beis Din of America, they know that if you tell people they can't get divorced, then one of the partners is simply just going to move in with someone else. That doesn't work today. But in Morocco, where the community was controlled by the rabbis, just because the husband wants to get a divorce, if the wife doesn't, because it's not just about love, remember. The husband has written he has to support the wife when he's married, and there's other things. So this idea, again, that we have about marriage, it was different in Morocco. And there's a traditional view that you don't make divorce easy, which goes back to the aguna problem. Many of these agunas are agunas only today because we believe that anyone who wants to get divorced should be allowed to get divorced. But two generations ago, just because the wife wants to get divorced, if the husband, if he's not evil, if he's not beating her, that doesn't make her an aguna. The Beis Din would not order a divorce. I'm not saying today that this is the proper approach. I think certainly we have to regard these women as agunas, and any woman who wants to get divorced, for whatever reason, we have to force the husband to do it. But that was not the traditional approach. The traditional approach was just like it was in Western law. You needed a cause. It had to be. It wasn't no-fault divorce. You needed a reason to get divorced. With this, we come to the end of Rav Mesas. Next week, we'll be beginning with Rav Avraham Shapiro. Lots of interesting stuff in that. And there's much more to say about Rav Mesas, but we've really come to an end if we want to get to Rav Avraham by next class. So does anyone have any questions or comments on this? I don't know about the... If anyone knows anything, we have some real Talmid HaChachamim here. Dovi Hoffman, who's an expert in the Sephardic Tshuvot. If you can find out something about what Rav Mesas is really talking about here, is there any practical implications to his idea that we can start allowing Pilagshim and I shouldn't say start allowing it. He doesn't say that. He says that there's no halachic prohibition. Is he responding to some concern there that there are people in Israel who want to be doing this? And he's commenting on another Moroccan rabbi sefer who also isn't speaking in practical terms. But the fact that he put it in the sefer and he quotes the other authorities who did in Morocco who did permit this halacha lemaisa. And if you want to see the examples, look in my article, if you read Hebrew, in the Chovei Torah Journal, the last issue, I cite them. But I don't know, because he doesn't explain what Rav Mesas was getting at. Does he really think that this was something realistic? Because I happen to agree with the people, when Svi Zohar wrote his article, he sent it to me, and I said it's impractical, it's impossible. We cannot institute Pilagshim concubinage. For all the good reasons that you offered, Svi Zohar, it would destroy the traditional Jewish marriage as we have it. And I said the best you could do is privately tell these people who are living in a Pilagshim relationship that, do what you need to do to lessen the Isur. But Because not everything's halacha. Just because something's halachically permissible, there's certain, we have a structure of a Jewish community and family life. Once you start having pilakshim, you're going to start having children, being married to concubines, and then you're going to have issues of child support, and then they're going to separate. And it's not a good thing for the Jewish community. Although I could see in a case where people were quite elderly and they refused to get married for all sorts of reasons, that you might come up with some solution. Yeah, well, I don't know why you say it's really controversial. His position is the mainstream position, that shadels, go to Borough Park, you'll see all these shadels, this is what everyone wears. I see what you're saying. No, you're thinking of Rav Yosef Mesas. So let me make a comment on this very quickly. Rav Yosef Mesas did hold that where all women, modest women, uncover their hair, then Jewish women don't need to cover their hair also. Rav Shalom Mesas criticizes his cousin, Rav Yosef Mesas, for this. And Rav Yosef Mesas was supported by Rav Shalom Moshe Malka, who also thought that today women do not need to cover their hair in a society that we are today. And this really was a typical viewpoint 40 years ago. So Rav Shalom Mesas is really taking it on both sides. He's attacking Rav Avadia on the right and trying to defend shadels against Rav Avadia, who's saying you can't have shadels. And on the left, he's fighting off his cousin Rav Yosef Mesas, who we will have a whole series of classes on, and Rav Moshe Malka, who want to say that today's day and age, b'chol, we don't need to cover the hair. And he has tshuvas directed, a very lengthy tshuva against Rav Yosef Mesas, and a shorter tshuva against Rav Moshe Malka on this point. That's a different Mesas. Mesas is an important family in Morocco. Okay, any further questions? He is a makel, but he is strict. I'll just give you an example. He has a big dispute with Rav Avadia about heating up food on Shabbos. Rav Avadia Yosef holds that you can heat up, let's say, chicken if you have, or meat, if you have some gravy. But it's not a lot of gravy. It's not like a soup or sort of thing. But she just has some gravy. Rav Mesas is absolutely not. If there's any liquid at all, you cannot heat it up. So here he's a machmir. He's more machmir than Rav Avadia. In the sefer I showed you last week, Yalkut Shemesh, you'll see on Or HaChaim, you'll see his pesukim. In some of them, he is more stringent than Rav Avadia. He's like every authentic posek. That is, you can't anticipate. Although most of the great poskim do tend towards leniency. Any posek who's always lenient is not an authentic posek, and you have plenty of examples where he comes down more stringent than other poskim. Well, I don't know, the yeshiva world, for their standpoint, they don't even know him. They have 8 volumes of Shailot and Tshuvot. You won't find them in the yeshiva world library. But they don't care about any of the Sephardic Gedolim. Rav Avadia Yosef is so overpowering and so important that he was able to break in to a certain extent. But that's not them. That's not their world. That's not their, they have their canon, and, he's not part of their canon unless you're in the Sephardic Yeshiva world. If you're in the Sephardic Yeshiva world, he's the second most important Sephardi posek of the last generation, after Rav Avadia. No, but with Rav Shalom Mesas, it's the cold chicken and covering your hair with a shadel. You have to go to Rav Yosef Mesas. If you want to see a makil, when we get to Rav Yosef Mesas, you'll see kuas like you wouldn't believe. They called him in Morocco, instead of Yosef HaMashbir, they referred to Rav Yosef Mesas as Yosef HaMatir. And we will see. He, as I mentioned, he's a Sephardic counterpart of Rav Chaim Hirschenson, and we'll do him in the future. No, Rav Avadia did not regret. On the contrary, they were the closest of friends. Rav Mesas maybe was his closest rabbinic colleague, a relationship of real love. Rav Avadia was the Masader Kiddushin. Rav Mesas was the Masader Kiddushin that I believe it was one of the grandchildren of. They had machlokas, but real rabbanim don't take it personally when you have machlokas. And if you look at Rav Mesas, he's always very respectful. He acknowledges that Rav Avadia is Mofet Hador, is the posek of the generation, but that doesn't mean that we give up our traditions, and that doesn't mean that I can't have my own opinion. So this was not personal. Rav Avadia has a personality issue with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, but it's a good point you raise, Yisrael, because all the other Sephardic posts can really fall in line behind Rav Avadia, except for Rav Mordechai Yahu. And Rav Mordechai Yahu and Rav Avadia, they obviously don't get along. Rav Avadia doesn't have any respect for Rav Mordechai. Rav Nesas, who Rav Avadia has the most respect for, incredible respect, he time after time disagrees with Rav Avadia. So here you have an unusual case of the only Sephardic Rav who is part of Rav Avadia's circle and yet takes him on time after time. I have great pictures. I put the book down from the biography of Rav Nesas. You see at the grave, Rav Avadia at the grave. They built him a beautiful grave. It's in Har HaManuchos. No, they were the closest of friends. I don't think Rav Avadia has any following in the Sephardic world or the Ashkenazic world. Rav Avadia was not—he really wasn't a Sephardic posek. He became an Ashkenazi in the sense that he learned his whole life in the Litvish yeshiva world. Let me tell you a quick story about Rav Avadia. Rav Avadia was the posek in Lakewood. People would wait outside, you know, in line, 10, 15 people after mincha to ask him shailos. All sorts of questions. On the hardest issues, the people today who run the Lakewood Yeshiva, these were people who asked him the Nida questions. They didn't follow him on, let's say, kashrus issues, but the most difficult shilas. But as I mentioned last time, for many people, the office is what makes the person. You could be brilliant, but if you have to be in a certain office. So look, if you're into YU, you know that certain Rosh Yeshiva YU left YU. Now today, who's ever heard of them? Rav Schechter is big enough that if he left YU, he'd still be big. Rav Avadia goes to Israel, and he opens up a little yeshiva. A person told me this from the Lakewood Yeshiva, who's a student of Rav Avadia, that when his father went to Israel, he went to Har Nof, he went to find Rav Avadia, and he went to the apartment building, and he couldn't find which apartment he's in. There wasn't a sign at the bottom, and he asked one of the people coming out of the apartment, where is Rav Avadia's apartment? And the person didn't know. And my colleague, his father started crying that here is someone who, when he was in Lakewood, people would stand 15, 20 people in line to ask him every shiloh. He was the postdoc of the yeshiva. And now in Israel, the person in his apartment building doesn't even know him. And these apartment buildings are all from people. And he was crying because, such a genius and someone with so much to offer, this is what became. But no, Rav Avadia does not have a following. He has a few people, but it's not a following. And it wouldn't have been a following in the Sephardic world. He's Syrian, but he never was one of the Syrian Rabbanim. The Syrian rabbinate had their own, and he spoke out against the Syrian ban on converts. So, yes, I know he moved back to Lakewood. And if you want to know where his biggest student in America today is actually Rav Baruch Simon of Yeshiva University, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at YU. He calls Rav Avadia a few times a week. He brings his shiurim there. He's a big Talmud of him. And there's no question Rav Avadia is brilliant. And sometimes it's the breaks. He never, he had this machlokas with the Rosh Yeshiva's wife. Here's the problem. If you run a yeshiva, these yeshivas are family institutions. So the most important person in the yeshiva has to be the Rosh Yeshiva. Unless you're a yeshiva like YU, in which there's no family really running it. He was more important and more popular than Rosh Yeshiva. You can't have a yeshiva when the Rosh Yeshiva is not the most significant person, when the posek overshadows the Rosh Yeshiva. And Rav Schneur Cutler, he inherited the yeshiva when he was quite young, and he didn't sit and learn for so many years like Rav Avadia and others. He had to start raising money almost immediately, and it became obvious to people that Rav Avadia really was the most learned and the major figure at the yeshiva, and this created problems with the Rebbetzin, who understandably wouldn't have wanted a situation like that, and then they started pressuring him to leave, and eventually it became untenable, and he opened up a kollel. He left the yeshiva, opened up a kollel, but what the bizayon is, and this is what the family will never forgive, is that once he left the yeshiva, they appointed them three or four guys to take, I shouldn't say guys, rabbanim, big rabbanim, to take over as poskim. So there's now three or four who decide psak for the yeshiva, but it's the family who call these people guys, because as far as they're concerned, these new rabbis have turned their back on their own Rebbe and want nothing to do with him. And so there's a big break with the family, and it's a sad situation. But he is one of the most original poskim of our time, but not in the sense of Ramosha Feinstein, because he doesn't have really the influence. And between you and me, part of it is the children. They could have turned him into having much more influence, but they have one son who, when they had this website, he answered people. Such chutzpah. I mean, here you see a psak, which is unusual, something you never heard of. Someone writes in, he explained the psak. And instead, he just would write back chutzpah, you know, we don't need to explain it, or isn't that? That's divrei Torah benachat nishmaim. You know, you have to explain things properly, because every single thing Rav Avadi says is based on halacha, and often on standard halacha, on Shulchan Aruch. It's just that we don't know anymore, because all the things we do in kashrus is not Shulchan Aruch. It's chumras, it's achronim, it's not the standard halacha, but the family could have turned him into, you know, leading rav in America, and I think a lot of the problem is one of the sons. It's a shame. Yeah, they all learned by him, and they all did shimush by him, and look, I'm not going to go as far as one of the sons who said that, you know, if you don't, it says in the Gemara, you're chayiv misa, you know, if you contradict your Rebbe and you do all this, obviously they're no fans of the current rabbanim there, but there's been cases like this before where big rabbis have been pushed out of their positions, and then they became small rabbis. Their learning is still the same. And we've had small rabbis, that is, rabbis who weren't recognized, but then they were brought into yeshivas and became recognized. So that's the situation for Avadi. So for good or for bad, he really doesn't have any influence. And for those who want to follow him, fine, but you should know he has incredible chumras also. It's not just kulas. He has some unbelievable chumras. That's all important posts can do. Okay. He had a wonderful relationship. He came to the shul once a year, and I mentioned last class, you might recall, that after Rav Yosef Messas died, the cousin, Rav Shalom, wanted to go to Israel and become chief rabbi there, and the king prevailed upon him not to, both the king and the Lubavitcher Rebbe. But then, a few years later, Messas says, I have to go. The king was always a protector of the Jews, they always had a great relationship, and it was a very good situation. Okay, we will meet again next class. For those who asked me, we have two more classes. Today is what, the 9th or the 10th? I don't even know the dates. Today's the 9th. Already I know for next semester we'll be picking up with these figures, Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan, Rav Yaakov Dov Volovsky, the Ridbaz, Rav Eliezer Berkovitz, and I think Rabbi Henkin. Someone asked me what I'm planning on doing. I'm doing Berkovitz because one of you asked me to do Berkovitz. So he will be at least three classes, I think. Today's the 8th. Okay, so today's May 8th. I will see you all next week, God willing. Good night.